Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Lee Strobel was an award-winning legal editor with the Chicago Tribune and a spiritual skeptic until 1981, when he embraced the Christian faith. He's gone on to write a number of books, including the best-selling The Case for Christ, The Case for a Creator, and The Case for Faith, which is now morphed into a DVD. He's a journalist, a thinker, a church pastor, and he's with us now. Lee Strobel, welcome to Open House.
Well, thanks so much. Great to be with you.
It's nice to have you on the show. Very interesting story that you have. We were just mentioning there in the intro about the award-winning legal editor for the Chicago Tribune. You originally described yourself as an atheist, didn't you? Not
right.
Just simply a skeptic, but actually an atheist.
Yeah, I was. I forgot how obnoxious I was about that. I got an email recently from a person I went to school with, and she had just found out I was a Christian, and she was aghast that I had made that move, because she said, all I remember in school was you attacking me. She said, I was a good Catholic girl, and you were the atheist, and all you would do is berate me over my faith. So I guess I was more obnoxious about it than I remember.
The thing that I laugh about now is that if you were to think back then, to think now what you've become, writing books like these, even being a church pastor, how would you think you would have felt back then?
I never would have anticipated. Even after I became a Christian, I thought that I'd just go to church and try to serve God and help people, and I had no idea I'd go into the ministry and be writing books. It's absolutely 180 degrees different than how I thought I'd be spending my life.
Yes, that's right. Well, let's just talk about that journey to faith,
sure,
that you actually had then. I'm really interested to know the kind of family that you grew up in and whether that had any influence in the kind of beliefs that you had earlier on.
Well, my parents were Christians, but they were not, I would say, a very mainstream Lutheran background.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to drag me to church when I was little, but I resisted it and pretty much successfully stayed out of that. They did bring me some, and I did go through a little bit of religious instruction, but never embraced it, never really followed it. And as soon as I got old enough not to go to church, I stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I was about 16, 17 years old, I considered myself an atheist, primarily because of things I'd learned about science that convinced me that God didn't exist. And I took a course on the New Testament from an atheist that convinced me that you can't trust the New Testament. And so I pretty much by age 16, 17 was pretty hardcore as a skeptic.
And then you meet your wife.
Yeah.
And she starts to have a bit of spiritual awakening herself, I believe.
Yeah, she was an agnostic. And we actually met when we were 14 years old. We were childhood sweethearts and got married and had a very happy marriage without God until she one day met a Christian who lived nearby, and they became best friends. And this Christian invited her to church, and my wife had almost never in her life been in a church, so she was kind of curious. She went and kind of investigated things and came to me one day and said, Lee, I've made a big decision. I've decided to become a follower of Jesus. And I thought this was absolutely the worst possible news I could get. I thought, oh, no. Divorce is the first word that went through my mind.
Oh,
it's not what I signed up for. It's not what I wanted. I knew there's going to be conflict and division in our marriage because of it, and I honestly thought we were going to break up. But what surprised me was in the months that followed, I began to see positive changes in her character and values, and it was intriguing and winsome. And so one day she said to me, it was a Sunday, she said, well, why don't you come to church with me today? And I thought, you know, I'm going to go and get her out of this cult, you know, that she's involved in. So I went, and there was a young pastor speaking, and he was so young, I don't even think he was shaving yet. His name was Bill Hybel, and he gave a talk called Basic Christianity, in which he just kind of set forth the basics of Christianity. And I honestly was taken aback, because a lot of my misconceptions were skewered at that point. And I walked out that day saying two things. Number one, I was still an atheist, because he hadn't convinced me that day that God exists.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, I realized, you know, if this stuff is true, this has huge implications. So that's the day I decided to use my legal training and journalism training and begin an investigation and just check out whether or not there's any evidence that supports any world religion, much less Christianity. And that's what launched me on what turned out to be almost a two-year investigation using the same techniques I would for the Chicago Tribune, investigating a story, interviewing experts, studying archaeology and history, science, and trying to sort through it all to see if it made sense.
What was your first question that you started to attacking? What was the first thing that you started to explore?
Well, it really struck me initially that there were three main issues. Number one, did science point toward or away from a creator? Assuming the answer to that was yes, then number two issue would be historical issues. Did Jesus claim to be the Son of God? Did he ever make that claim? And number three, did he back up that claim by returning from the dead? Those seem to be kind of the core issues. And first I had to determine, is there a God? Is there a creator? What does science say about that? Did it rule it out, or did it point in that direction? And then, of course, the issue of Jesus, if Jesus was God. A lot of people said he never even claimed he was God. Was that true? And if he did claim it, anybody can claim it. Did he back it up by his resurrection?
Huh. Over that 2 years, how did you feel? I mean, that's a long time to really be seeking through issues of faith. Some people would have given up. Some people would have lost interest. How did you feel over that time?
I was really surprised that it because I did not consider myself, obviously a spiritual person, but I was intrigued by it. What really shocked me was, as I would investigate, I would begin to see evidence that really surprised me. I had an interview recently, or actually it was a couple years ago now, with Hugh Hefner, the founder of Playboy. Mm. And he was shocked when I told him that there's actual historical evidence for the resurrection. He said, nobody's ever talked to me about that before. Nobody's ever even suggested that there's any historical evidence. And I was kind of that way. I was kind of like, this is amazing to me as I investigated it, as I looked at in the area of science, at cosmology and physics and biochemistry and genetics and so forth, as I began to look at the implications of those fields, especially the discoveries over the last 50 years. And then I started to look at the historical evidence for Jesus. Honestly, I was intrigued. And, you know, I always enjoyed the investigatory phase as a journalist, really pursuing a story and trying to get at the root of it and find out what's true and what isn't. And I just was kind of drawn into this, and I found it fascinating.
Mm-hmm. This is Open House right across Australia. The openhouse.net.au carries the podcast for our chat with Lee Strobel, author of The Case for Christ, The Case for a Creator, so many books, including the best-selling Case for Faith. Now, give me your definition of faith, Lee, because I think we'll explore some of the answers that you actually discovered. But first of all, we need a definition of faith.
Faith, I think a good synonym is trust. It's where is the evidence pointing? We put our faith in things every single day. You know, I'm sitting here, for instance, I'm here in Southern California, and I was just drinking from a bottle of water. You know, that involves a certain amount of faith. I mean, how do I know that it's not poison? Well, you know, it's labeled from a reputable water manufacturer. It's I opened the bottle, knew it was not unsealed before. It looks clear. It smells all right. I don't know of anybody who's been sickened by drinking this brand. Mm-hmm. And so I've got really good evidence that this is safe to drink. But I still have to take a step of faith by taking a drink. I could be wrong. It could be poison. Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody gave it to me trying to kill me. So, you know, a lot of the evidence points to this being safe, but there's still a step of faith. And the same is true in religion. You know, the question is, where does the evidence point? Does it point away from God or toward God? And ultimately, you can look at the evidence, and I believe it points toward God, but there's still a step of faith involved. But that's a rational step because it's in the same direction that the evidence is pointing. If it were upstream, swimming against the current of evidence, then I'd say that's irrational. But if the evidence is pointing in a direction, then taking a step of faith in that same direction and putting our trust in what we believe to be true, that is, God being real and Jesus being his son, that to me makes sense.
All right, bringing the rational and the faith together.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, let's explore some of the eight common objections to belief that you raise in The Case for Christ. And one of those ones that I wanted to explore with you certainly connects in with the first point that you started searching when you were seeking out all these answers for yourself, is the whole question of miracles and whether they contradict science. And if they do, well, then they can't be true.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people would claim that that the supernatural doesn't exist, so they rule it out at the outset. They say miracles are impossible because they contradict science, and therefore it's not possible. And so now, give me your evidence for God, because miracles obviously don't exist. Well, you know, if I drop an apple, the law of gravity of science, the law of gravity tells me it's going to hit the ground. But if I drop it with one hand and reach in with the other one and grab it before it hits the ground, I've not overturned the law of gravity. I've merely intervened. And we do that all the time. And so it seems to me that if the evidence points toward a creator of the universe, a God who created the universe, then for him to intervene from time to time does not overturn the laws of nature. He created the laws of nature. He can certainly do that just as I intervened and grabbed the apple. So I don't think it's contrary to logic to say that miracles might happen. I think the question is a worldview question. It's a philosophical question. Do you accept the possibility of the supernatural? If you rule it out at the outset, no, you're going to rule it out. If you say with some humility, I guess I don't know all that is possible and impossible, so I'm just going to go wherever the evidence takes me, then maybe it would point toward the direction of the miraculous happening. I think of Anthony Flew, you know, probably the greatest philosophical atheist in the world, who you know, wrote books like The Presumption of Atheism, who wrote you know, more than a dozen books on atheism, preached atheism at major universities in Europe for his whole life, for 50 years, and yet announced a couple of years ago, oops, I was wrong. I now believe in God. All my life I've been an atheist, and I was wrong. And I interviewed him about that, and I said, Dr. Flew, this is incredible that you would reverse a lifetime of atheism because you now believe in God. I said, that takes a lot of guts. He said, well, I had to follow the evidence wherever it takes me.
Yes.
And I think that's intellectual honesty. He looked at the evidence of science and believes that it points toward a creator. And he was honest enough to say, oops, I was wrong. A creator does exist. And so I think in the area of miracles, we have to say, if I have good historical evidence that the resurrection is true, then a miracle has taken place. If I have evidence that there's a creator, then the biggest miracle has taken place, which is the creation of the universe. And so, I would want to keep an open mind on those things.
Yes. I've got a couple of questions on the nature of God, but one before that that you raise in The Case for Faith is, church history is littered with oppression and violence, i.e., if the church is God's very body on earth, it hasn't been looking very well over the last few centuries.
Yeah, I think you know, there's no question that there's been terrible things done in the name of a lot of different religions, including Christianity. The question is, are those activities consistent with the teachings of the faith? And in the case of Christianity, I look at Jesus and his teachings, and I see some of the things done in furtherance of his name, and I say, you know what, they don't match up. And consequently, who do I blame? Do I blame the people who, for whatever self-motivated reason, chose to violate the fundamental teachings of Jesus? Or do I blame Jesus for it? It's kind of hard to blame Jesus for it when it's the actions of people who are claiming, whether they are or not, claiming to be his followers. I think there have been you know, some exaggerations in terms of some of the historical issues involved, and that's certainly been debated in recent years. But we have to go back and say, what are the teachings of the founder of the church? I think those are the things we have to ask ourselves, whether they make sense, whether they're ethical and moral, and whether they lead to a better place. And, you know, you look at the 20th century, who was it that really was responsible for millions upon millions upon millions of innocent deaths? You know, it's atheistic societies, it's the Khmer Rouge, it's Mao, it's Stalin, it's Hitler. These are not Christians who are motivated by following Jesus. I mean, you know, and I don't want to say that in order to justify anything that was done by the church. I think there's been instances of things that people have done, as I say, in the name of Jesus, that the church has rightly apologized for.
Absolutely. This is Open House right across Australia, and we're talking to Lee Strobel, the author of The Case for Faith, the openhouse.net.au for the podcast. Okay, this is another big objection that you explore in the book as well, is God isn't worthy of worship if he kills innocent children. And you quote Thomas Jefferson there, who believed that the God of the Old Testament was, quote, cruel, vindictive, capricious, and unjust. Obviously, he was talking about those passages in the Old Testament where God commands Israel to destroy other nations completely. That is a big one. A lot of people do get very stumped over that portrayal of God that we actually see in the Old Testament.
Right. You know, this is an issue that I had a big problem with when I was an atheist. And in my book, I go in a whole chapter on this to try to kind of unravel it and see, you know, if this makes sense or not. And, you know, I interviewed Dr. Norman Geisler, who's a scholar on this issue, and he said, you know, you look at the individual passages that this talks about, for instance, the Amalekites, who one of the people involved here. He said, you know, you have to do the research, understand this was a thoroughly depraved culture whose mission was to commit genocide, which was to destroy Israel. And you have to think about it, if Israel was the chosen people through whom God was going to bring salvation to the entire world through Jesus, then it even adds greater gravity to their depravity. Had there been some hardcore remnant that had survived, they could easily have resumed their aggression against Israel. So this is not an issue of God acting capriciously. This is a consequence of horribly sinful societies that were endangering others and ultimately endangering Israel, through which the Son of God would come. So, you know, I think you have to unravel some of the issues here and weigh whether or not God acted appropriately. We can't really judge God in terms of how we judge humans. In other words, you know, if I go in my neighbor's yard and rip up his shrubbery, that's inappropriate. For him to go out there and rip it out and do something else is appropriate. Why? Because it's his. He created it, in a sense. He grew it. God, at some point, he is the creator. He has a different standard than we do in terms of how he interacts with humankind. And it's one of those issues that it's hard to give a 15-second soundbite on, because it really requires going through and looking at these passages, as I do in the book, to really, you know, set them forth and say, is this capricious and arbitrary, or is this a righteous response to a situation full of unrighteousness?
I'd love to know your answer to the whole, you know, is there a difference between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New? Because a lot of people, researchers included, actually would go and say, even some scholars would actually say, yes, there's a different God in the Old Testament to the nice and friendly, enemy-loving God in the form of Jesus that we actually find in the New Testament.
Well, yeah, I disagree with that. In fact, I had actually asked Dr. Geisler about that when I interviewed him, and I talk about this in the book, and he actually went through some analysis of words in the Old Testament versus the New Testament describing God and so forth, and found that, interestingly, the New Testament has more references to judgment blood and so forth than the Old Testament
does.
So, you know, it's easy to isolate passages, but you find a gracious and a loving God in the Old Testament. You find him in the New Testament. But you find a righteous God in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. A lot of people like to think, well, you know, God is love, right? And yeah, absolutely. But he isn't only love. He's also righteous. He also must deal with sin. He must deal with rebellion and so forth. And that's part of God's nature as well. And sometimes when we focus merely on one aspect of it, we get a skewed picture of God. I was just looking at my interview with Dr. Geisler here, but he said, if you do a study of the Bible, every time the Bible uses the word that the King James Version translated as mercy, it's used 261 times in the Bible. 72% of them are in the Old Testament. So that's mercy, 72% in the Old Testament. It's a 3-to-1 ratio. The word love occurs 322 times in the Bible. It's about half in each Testament. So you have the same emphasis on love in both. So, you know, I think it's an oversimplification to say that we have a different character of God in the Old and New Testament. I think God is consistent. How it plays out in human history has reflected the circumstances that have evolved over time.
In the book, you also quote Mark Twain, who says, "Heaven for the climate, hell for the companionship."
Yeah. Yeah,
that
right.
Raises another question about the whole thing of hell and whether a loving God would, you know, torture people in hell forever and ever and ever.
Yeah, I think I like what C.S. Lewis talked about when he talked about hell. The door is locked from the inside, in a sense. In other words, nobody is sent to hell. People pretty much send themselves there. You know, I think for some people, heaven would be hell. I know some atheists for whom the idea of spending eternity in the presence of a holy God would be hell to them. They would hate that. I think God respects our judgment and respects our decisions that we make. And for those that live in this life and say, I don't care about God, I'm not interested in being in a relationship with him, it's like, that's fine. I mean, then he will seal that decision at death forever. Those that say they want to be in a relationship with God, he offers forgiveness and eternal life is a free gift to anyone, anywhere, at any time who says they want it.
He's done everything that he needs to do, hasn't he?
I think that's magnanimous. And I think God and Jesus, who went through such hell, so to speak, in terms of paying for the wrongs of humankind through the cross, you know, has certainly gone to extraordinary lengths to reconcile humankind with himself. And yet he respects our free will. You know, frankly, it's our choice.
Yeah. Lee, wanted to leave this one to the end because this is the big one that so many people wrestle with, and it is very hard to have definitive answers for, but the objection goes like this: since evil and suffering exist in the world, a loving God cannot.
Right. Yeah, and that's certainly the number one objection to Christianity, I think, and to faith in general in the world. I've actually done some studies on it, public opinion studies, and found that to be true. I think it's a legitimate question. I think there's several things to be said about it. The film I just did, The Case for Faith, deals with it in depth. One thing to consider about it is, I would say that is the number one objection against Christianity, and yet I've got, say, 20 or so arguments on the other side of the scale pointing toward the truth of the Christian faith. You have to start out and say, okay, well, let's keep this into context here. You know, I've got these 20 other lines of reasoning I could develop that point toward the existence of the Christian God, and I've got this mainly this one argument on the other side. So I think that's important to keep into perspective. That doesn't diminish it, but I think it's important to keep into perspective. I think the number one thing to remember is that God, you know, love is the greatest value in the universe. Love existed in the Godhead from eternity past, and when God created humankind, he wanted us to have the capacity to love, and the capacity to love must involve choice. When I was little, my sister had some dolls that she would play with, and one of them had a string on the back that you pull, and the doll would say, "I love you," you know. Well, that doll didn't love her. It was a mechanical device that was forced to say that, and God could have created us as puppets who were forced to say we love God.
Yes.
But that's not love. He had to give us free choice, and when he gave us free choice, it was the choice to love or not to love. And honestly, you talked about history earlier, look through history. I mean, we have taken that free choice, and whereas we could extend a hand of help to people in need, we often extend it with a knife or a gun, or turn our backs in indifference. A lot of the evil and suffering in the world is a result of that. When we look at that, we have to say, you know, I don't think God was the creator of that. I think he created a world with the potentiality of it, but we realize that potentiality. Chesterton once wrote to the newspaper that asked the question, you know, what's the biggest problem in the world? And he wrote in the letter and said, "I am." I think sometimes we got to look in the mirror and respond to that. But
of course, the argument goes that, of course, that's fine for human caused evil, but what about tsunamis and what about disasters and all of those kinds of things that human beings, you know, can't really say that they can take responsibility for, quote unquote.
Right, and I think there's a couple of things with that. One is the degree to which humankind has, in many cases, put ourselves in the path of some of those predictable disasters. Building cities in bowls like New Orleans is probably not the brightest thing in the world to do, below sea level, protected by some inefficient
levees
dams
and things.
But the other issue is, I think when humankind first told God to shove off, he partially did. And I think that's when we not only moral evil entered the world, but I think natural problems entered into the world as well. The Bible talks about the earth groaning, and it's not as God created it, and that's certainly consistent with Christian theology, that the world as God created it is not the world in which we live.
Yeah. In fact, in the book, you actually quote Peter Kreeft, an academic on these things, saying that evil could even be a proof for God.
Yeah, in the sense that how do you measure what's evil if there is no good to measure it against?
Yeah,
you know, it almost,
it's a good point.
It almost presupposes there is a standard of good in order to say something, because what is evil is something that falls short of that standard of good, and without that standard of good, you really have no way of measuring evil. I mean, everything becomes relative. How can I say that Hitler was wrong if there is no standard of good? There is an absolute right and wrong that comes from God, and therefore we can measure the evil of someone like Hitler.
Yes.
So I think he's right. I think the existence of evil points toward the existence of God.
Yeah. Well, Lee, fascinating to talk to you. I want to just wrap up with why you personally believe, at the end of your two-year search, when you're looking at those three things, the science, Jesus' claims about himself, it may be the resurrection. What did it for you, and why do you still believe all of these years later?
Well, what did it for me was the preponderance of the evidence. It just, as I weighted on the scales, I looked and I said, you know what, it would take more faith to maintain my atheism than it would to become a Christian, in the sense that to maintain my atheism in light of the evidence for science, for the existence of God, and from history for the resurrection, I'd have to swim upstream against that current of evidence flowing the other direction. And I couldn't do that. I was trained in journalism and law to respond to truth. And so for me, it was not that hard of a decision, in the sense that I felt the decision was made for me. I mean, it was the most logical and rational thing I could do, take a step of faith in the same direction the evidence is pointing. And I think that's the same thing that keeps my faith alive today, is that conviction that, you know, this is not a flight of fancy. It's not a wishful thinking. It's not mythology or legend. It's based on historical bedrock. And the more I hear objections to the evidence and the more I check it out, the more they fall flat. I've yet to read something that has convinced me that that fundamental case for a creator and the case for Christ are flawed. Yeah, there are issues that we don't have 100% of knowledge on, and yes, there are questions we're going to take to the grave, but that's not to say it's irrational to take a step of faith. We can hold certain questions in tension as long as we have adequate evidence pointing toward the truth of what it is we're putting our trust in.
Yeah. Well, Lee Strobel, I do appreciate your time on Open House. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been good to talk to you. Lee Strobel, author of The Case for Christ, The Case for a Creator, so many other books as well, including the one we've been talking about tonight, The Case for Faith.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.